Hello, I'm Kamal Santa Maria. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, a year of the Biden presidency. He took over a lockdown economy, a result of the first year of the pandemic. Now the US has seen something of an economic recovery, but do everyday Americans see the boom? And in running the economy hot, people are also feeling the pinch. Inflation's hit an almost 40-year high. Can Joe Biden bring down the rising cost of living in his second year as president? While in Turkey, the president's going unorthodox. Recep Tayyip Erdogan has cut interest rates despite spiraling inflation, quite the opposite to what mainstream economists suggest. So why is the currency crash not worrying him? So how do you define a successful first year in charge of a country? There are so many metrics, and when you add in a pandemic, well, there's a lot to sort out. Ask Joe Biden and his team, and they'd say it's been a success. The economy recovered faster from the pandemic than most others, and based on some of the 10 main market indicators, the economy has improved more in Biden's first term than any of his predecessors in the past 50 years. Here are the numbers to back it all up. Strong consumer demand. It helped the economy grow an estimated 7% in the final quarter of last year, though that may well slow down as Omicron takes effect. But the stock market's been thriving. The S&P 500 index, for example, had a great run in 2021, rising more than 25%. Unemployment, such an important indicator, it fell from 6.3% to 3.9%. Employers added 6.4 million jobs, the most of any first-year president. And jobless claims hit a 50-year low, although the US is still around 3.6 million jobs short of pre-pandemic levels. But interestingly, wages have gone up. The average hourly pay jumped 4.7% in December. Part of that is the scramble to find and hold on to workers after a record number of people actually quit their jobs. It's a phenomenon known as the Great Resignation. Now, all of that is quite remarkable, but not necessarily in the view of many American voters. Two separate polls show a majority describing the economy as poor or fair and disapproving of Biden's handling of the situation. And then there are the everyday problems. Supply chain problems leaving supermarket shelves bare, groceries and petrol costing much more, inflation climbing to 7%, the biggest 12-month gain for 40 years. Let's start things off with this report from Mike Hanna in Washington, D.C.
Prices for groceries, rent and other needed items continue to soar. The owners of small shops are particularly hard hit as they see their customers beginning to treat what were everyday purchases as luxuries.
You can see how the money flows. You can see when people are not getting the extras, when they're getting coffee, drip coffee instead of cappuccino. You can see it. You can see how they pay if they're paying in coins.
The increase in prices is now being felt at every gas station and in every grocery store.
I just think we're a little more careful. I notice it in almost every product, fruits, vegetables, which we buy a lot of, deli products. I can't really see anywhere that the prices have gone down, but they've gone up.
Bottlenecks in the supply chains of distributors are the primary reason, and these in turn are the direct result of staffing shortages as the pandemic continues to rage worldwide. At this stage, though, the head of the Federal Reserve insists there's no need for panic, that this is a temporary situation.
We will use our tools to support the economy and a strong labor market and to prevent higher inflation from becoming entrenched.
It's a similar message coming from the White House, which points to a dropping unemployment rate as evidence that economic recovery is underway and is adamant that the supply chain issue will be resolved.
We are well positioned to attack the challenges of prices and costs head on, and that's exactly what the president and this administration are doing.
But Republicans continue to blame stimulus measures for overheating the economy. One thing is clear. It's impossible to predict the ongoing economic impact of the Omicron variant surge, which the nation continues to face.
I don't believe we've seen the peak yet here in the United States.
The rise in price increases reflect a harsh reality that in a pandemic, it's not just people who get sick, but the economy as well.
Well, let's get into it all now with James Knightley, who is the chief international economist with ING. He's with us from New York today. James, thanks so much for your time. Inheriting a lockdown economy is how I've described what Joe Biden got. Not an easy position to be in. Not dissimilar to Barack Obama many years ago when he inherited a faltering economy as well. Using that as a baseline, has he done well?
Yeah, you would look at an economy today that is actually substantially larger than it was before the pandemic struck. I mean, the economy in the US is now 1.4 percentage points bigger than it was. So on the face of it, what the economy and what the global economy has gone through, that is a remarkable achievement. However, you look at other aspects of the US economy and you can see that there are 3.6 million people fewer in work than the pandemic struck. So there's still clearly quite a lot of healing to do and quite a lot of action that the US authorities still need to do to get the economy fully back on its feet.
OK, let's go with jobs then, seeing as you've mentioned it, 3.6 million fewer, but unemployment is down, jobless claims are down as well. It feels like a mixed bag, but generally it's a good story, the employment side of things?
Yes. I mean, the thing is, there's something for everyone. Within the US data on the jobs market, unemployment has broken below 4%, which on the face of it is a fantastic outcome. However, you look at the other aspects of what's going on in the jobs market and why is it that unemployment has fallen so sharply without the jobs being created? And that's because workers have just vanished. The labor force participation rate is well below where it was pre-pandemic. It's actually only about 62%. That's substantially below where we were 20 years ago when we're up at sort of 67, 68%. So there has been a vanishing of people. And why is this? Well, partly it is suggested that there has been a lot of early retirements, but also at the lower end of the income distribution, we're seeing a lot of people missing from people who work in retail, people who work in leisure and hospitality. And this is a bit of a conundrum for the US authorities, because it's also meaning that companies that want to expand and take advantage of vigorous growth in the US economy can't, because they haven't got the workforce to do that. And that's putting upward pressure on wages. And that in turn is going to put upward pressure on inflation, which in turn is putting upward pressure on interest rates in the US.
Yeah. Talk me through inflation, if you would, please, James. Well, when a president in his first year is happy to come out and say, yes, this is bad, it's at a 40-year high and we need to do something, but then he's clearly acknowledging that there is something at play here. In basic terms, what is at play for it to have reached such high levels?
It's a combination of factors. One is on the demand side. When you throw $5 trillion of stimulus at an economy, some of that is going to stick and actually work. And that is why we have got an economy that is larger than it was before the pandemic. So the demand side is very vigorous. But at the same time, the supply side capacity of the US economy to meet that demand hasn't grown. In fact, it's probably shrunk, as we can tell, with the loss of workers in the US economy, the supply chain strains that we're all well aware of, the chip shortages. So that sort of demand supply mismatch means that there's a lot of money chasing not as many goods. I mean, you look at it in the car market in particular, where used car prices have risen the best part of 40% in the last year because you just can't get hold of a brand new car. So these sorts of dislocations of bottlenecks in amidst good demand is really what's driving the inflation story. Okay.
James, I want to drill down into something a bit more policy related in some detail. So just bear with me a second while I sort of go through this with our viewers. Build back better.
Sure.
Three words which were at the core of Joe Biden's economic plans. An act which includes social policy, hundreds of billions of dollars for climate change programs, an increase in taxes on corporations and the richest individuals. All, though, put in doubt because of senators from Joe Biden's own party who said they wouldn't support it. The president, however, did sign into law a $1 trillion infrastructure bill aiming to protect communities against climate fuel disasters and among some other projects. Now, I don't want to get, James, into too much of the politics of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and the likes, because that's a whole other story. But, you know, everything in Build Back Better sounded like it was positive and strong. Why couldn't it get the support?
Yeah, it's interesting. We've seen this basically being sliced and sliced and sliced. It's smaller and smaller each time. It initially started out as a $2.2 trillion plan, then it became a $1.7 trillion plan, and is now down towards closer towards $1 trillion in terms of the additions into the infrastructure bill that has already passed. There's a physical infrastructure bill of $1 trillion that has got through. But as you say, this sort of Build Back Better social policy, green climate-related aspect is struggling. And this largely centres on, again, this inflationary aspect that some people within his own party are anxious that we've got a highly inflationary economy that's very, very strong as well. And this is just going to add more fuel to the fire. Mm. And people are very nervous about inflation. People can feel it in their pockets. The value of their dollar doesn't go as far as it used to. And that has led to consumer confidence falling away quite sharply. So there is this sort of anxiety, not just amongst his own, amongst the Republicans, but as I say, even amongst his own party about what this means for household finances over the medium to longer term. So it's all about this concern that inflation could really take hold and we might end up seeing the Federal Reserve taking more aggressive action than slow the economy. So it could, in some people's minds, actually be counterproductive. And that's why I think there is some hesitancy amongst some members of his own party to back it.
And I wonder if that will lead to hesitancy or a change, at least, in Joe Biden's path. This is perhaps a more political question, but when you've put everything into this idea of building back an infrastructure and it hasn't really worked in the first term, and you want to get re-elected not just in 3 years' time, but you want to win the midterms in a year's time as well, and the people aren't responding to it that well, maybe there's a change in tack needed.
That's quite possibly true. We had Joe Biden's big speech, which was hoping to be a big reset of his policies. You know, we'd find out what he plans to do. And in the end, he kind of got sort of stuck down into Russian politics and you know, the politics of Ukraine. And so we haven't got a clear vision, really. And this is a challenge because domestic political factors really drive US elections. We have to admit that. And those domestic political considerations are very tough. Joe Biden is the least popular president of all time, if you exclude Donald Trump. So that just shows you how, you know, politically fraught it is all in the US right now. And as you say, the midterm elections are just in November. And it looks as though the Democrats could lose control of the House and possibly also lose control of the Senate. And if you haven't got control of Congress, you can't get your legislation passed. So this is a real issue for Biden and the Democrats. Unless we can turn things around, get the popularity, get the poll ratings rising, the second term, the second half of his term is going to be really stuck in terms of domestic agenda. He's going to end up being forced down what Donald Trump had to do and used and focus on areas of political or presidential executive authority, which basically means he's sort of resolved to do international relations and trade. Yeah. And that is not what really sort of floats people's excitement in US domestic politics. So it's going to be a very, very challenging environment for him if he can't turn things around very, very quickly.
Just finally, James, what has Joe Biden got left to fire, as it were, you know, as economic tools? I mean, he's tapped strategic oil reserves. As you said, there's been individual payouts. And is there anything left, in your opinion, that could work?
Yeah, I mean, well, Build Back Better isn't dead yet, we have to say. And it does look as though what they're going to try and do is break this up into little parts and then put it under the umbrella of Build Back Better, because it's clear that, you know, some of his own party won't back the full package of everything, you know, this extra significant source of money thrown at the economy. But if he breaks it down into little parts that even some Republicans may back, they can get lots of little quick wins that could build up to a bigger win in the election in November. So it's not all completely lost.
James Arntley, a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for breaking it all down for us and explaining so clearly. Really appreciate it. Now, here's a slightly different approach to inflation woes. In fact, it's more than slightly different. It goes against what many mainstream economists think. But that is not stopping the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He's repeatedly described himself as an enemy of interest rates, believing high borrowing costs is what increases inflation. So he's cutting interest rates. Erdogan's goal is to boost growth and to free the economy from the burden of higher interest rates, which he says are imposed on Turkey by, and these are his words, the global barons of finance. The president is targeting a new economic model in which cheap credit would help attract investments, raise employment and exports, and boost Turkey's independence from other countries. But Turks, well, they've been queuing up to buy cheap bread as inflation has soared to more than 36% last month compared to a year ago. That was the sharpest rise in almost 20 years. The cost of electricity, natural gas, fuel, they've all jumped as well. And, of course, there's been a dramatic fall in the value of the Turkish lira. It lost 44% of its value against the US dollar last year. Now, Erdogan has introduced a mechanism, if you like, that promises to compensate holders of the lira when the currency weakens to a certain level. The measure had reversed the lira slide and triggered a big surge in its value in late December. Minimum wage was also raised by 50%, and the government boosted its match on private contributions to public pensions. Now, that, of course, has all been costly. Turkey's central bank has had to sell from its foreign exchange reserves to shore up the lira. But it's not all bleak. The country showed positive figures for industrial production and retail sales. That was in November. The government says exports in the first half of last year hit $100 billion, which was the highest six-month figure ever. The World Bank estimated Turkey's economy to have grown 9.5% in 2021. And President Erdogan says he is determined to put Turkey into the world's top 10 economies. There's a lot to unpack there, and we're going to do that with Carlos de Souza joining us from Zurich. He is the emerging markets strategist and portfolio manager at the Zurich-based asset management firm Vontobel. And it's great to have you with us, Carlos. As I read through all of those things, it's a bit of a roller coaster, isn't it? And I'm starting to wonder, first of all, your views on this sort of reverse thinking which President Erdogan is employing.
Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you for having me. Yeah, I mean, Erdogan's views on interest rates and inflation are quite unconventional, as you have mentioned. It's not quite clear why he believes that higher interest rates actually drive higher inflation. This is, as you have mentioned, the opposite of what we economists believe. And one explanation, potentially in the short term at least, is that last year, he gave the chance to the central bank to raise interest rates to fight inflation, mm-hmm. and inflation actually accelerated, which kind of proved him right, at least in the short term. Now, I'm not saying he's right, but there were other causes of inflation increasing in Turkey last year and all over the world. There was the reopening of the economies, there were supply side constraints, there was more monetary expansion in 2020. So lots of reasons for inflation to go up. And just interest rates don't have an effect on inflation that is immediate. Mm-hmm. It just takes a while for interest rates to transmit into the economy and really lower inflation. So now he thinks he's had enough of high interest rates and he's trying his own way. I'm skeptical that it's going to work, but let's see about that.
Well, it's like he wants to be the guy who is the low interest rates man, because that's going to appeal, obviously, to people. Plus, he talks about foreign financial tools and global barons of finance. What's he talking about there?
I mean, it's funny that he's blaming foreign investors right now, because the currency crisis that Turkey experienced at the end of 2021 is very different from the one that Turkey experienced in 2018. In 2021, it was actually domestic savers, so basically Turkish citizens, who were driving the weakness of the Turkish liras, not foreign investors, like in 2018 when Turkey had a very large current account deficit and foreign investors were pulling out of Turkey. So those portfolio outflows were causing or were the trigger of the lira depreciation in 2018. In 2021, it's just that Turkish citizens want to protect themselves from inflation. As you mentioned, it reached 36% in December. So they were all dollarizing. They were converting their holdings of Turkish liras, their savings, into U.S. dollars and other currencies to protect their purchasing power, which makes sense. So I think it's more of just a rhetoric to blame foreign players. The truth is that we have left Turkey quite a while ago, most foreign investors. So we're not driving the lira here. It is actually Turkish citizens who don't trust their own currency.
Right. So let's expand on that with this sort of this mechanism that Erdogan put in place. $10 billion worth of lira, I think, and 300,000 citizens participated in it. It's almost like a populist move. It's a good idea and it shows people that he's doing something, but you can't maintain that.
That's right. In the short term, it seems to be working. In the short term, it did make the currency appreciate or regain part of the losses of the previous 2 months. But in the medium term, I very much doubt it can work. Why? because it is the government and the central bank who will compensate Turkish savers for the Turkish lira depreciation. This means that as the Turkish lira eventually depreciates, and it will have to depreciate when you have more than 30% inflation, the currency cannot be stable. It's just not possible because it will just make imports much cheaper, and this will make the current account widen in an unsustainable way. So there is just no way that any country in the world, not just Turkey, any country in the world, can have high inflation and a stable currency.
Of course, but the low currency, the low currency, Erdogan likes that as well, doesn't he? He says that's actually a good factor. It's good for exports and for boosting the economy that way.
It is good for exports. It is good for tourism, of course. It does boost the economy to some extent. But it just means that the currency is really cheap right now and it's really competitive right now. In 1 year's time, if you accumulate, say, 40% inflation, quite likely, then in real terms, the currency will be 40% more expensive than today. So in 1 year, if the currency remains stable, it will not be competitive anymore, which is why it has to depreciate. And once it depreciates, then the government, the treasury, will have to pay all these depositors, these 10 billion that you mentioned, they will have to compensate them, partly the treasury and partly the central bank. Hmm. So that's more deficit, that's more money printing, that means more inflation in the medium term. And so it's a bit of a vicious circle in the medium term. Right now, it has worked. It has changed expectations of the people. People are no longer afraid of holding liras because they will be compensated, which is all that they want. They want their purchasing power to be maintained like we all do. But medium term, I don't see this working.
Okay, you refer to, quite rightly, the medium term, short term, long term. Have you got any thoughts on what that timescale actually is? Because as we said, you can't keep propping up the currency like this all the time. And there's got to be some long-term plan here. It all just seems to be, it all feels very short-termist.
Yes, I think for the next 6 months, it will probably work. I don't see this as a major problem in the next 6 months because the Turkish lira is so competitive right now. It can withstand some appreciation in real term. But if this is maintained through the next 2 years, it will become extremely costly for the government. It will become quite costly in terms of money printing for the central bank as well. So I want to highlight that one of the strengths of the Turkish economy is the levels of public debt are really quite low. There were around 40% of debt to GDP back in November. The latest figures are not yet published. It will be a little bit higher with the depreciation, but still really quite low compared to most emerging markets. And what's going to happen with this scheme is that if it is maintained for, say, 2 years at least, then the deficits will accumulate and it will accumulate quite some public debt. So the main strength of the current economy will be weakened. It will no longer be such a strength as it is today. And Carlos, that's a problem.
Carlos, let's move away from sort of the numbers and the policy and actually talk about Turkey's economy itself. If President Erdogan wants to get Turkey into the world's top 10 economies, which is very ambitious. What's going to take it there? Just tell our viewers about what Turkey has to offer the rest of the world, I guess.
That's a bit of a more abstract question. I think growth is never been or rarely been a problem in Turkey. It's a high potential growth economy because they have relatively high population growth. They have quite a relatively diversified economy, so growth is really not a problem. To become top 10, I think that will take a very, very long time. I don't think Erdogan will, it's not a matter of just a few years. This can take several decades. And I think a very high inflation like the one Turkey has right now is a big problem. It's a challenge to achieve these ambitions because typically countries that have 30, 40, 50% inflation, they're not stable. And Turkey, even though it has had high inflation for the last 4 years, double-digit inflation since early 2017, not as high as today, but high inflation. And that has been a source of recurrent crises in Turkey. So if you have a high potential growth, but you have very frequent crises, at the end, the accumulated growth over the long term is not as high as of a country that maybe has a little bit less growth, but it's much more stable, that it doesn't have such frequent crises. So if they want to achieve this ambitious, they have to tackle inflation, really. I think this is very important. And I don't see the current policies as being the way to success, quite frankly.
Carlos de Souza, talking turkey with us this week on Counting the Cost. Thank you for your time. We do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. But do let me know what you're thinking, what you would like to see on the show as well. You can tweet or DM me at KamalAJE. Please use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or if email's more your thing, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. And there's plenty more as well online at aljazeera.com/CTC. Takes you straight to our homepage with individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on whenever you'd like. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Kamal Santamaria. From the whole team, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.